Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte City Councilman Tariq Bakari prepares to take a job in the Trump administration as deputy administrator at the Federal Transit Administration. We'll talk about what that means. The city continues to woo the CIAA tournament in efforts to convince them to bring that basketball tournament back to Charlotte. Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden clarifies his position on issues dealing with ICE, even as immigration courts here experience one of the worst backlogs in the nation. CMS unveils their budget for the next school year. Fires continue to rage in the mountains, with evacuations ordered in some areas. And the new transgender bill makes its way through the General Assembly. Is this HB 2.1? Here to talk about those stories and more is WFAE News politics reporter Steve Harrison. He's here along with the station's race and equity reporter Julian Berger. Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. And Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV. Thank you all for being here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was you who broke the news that four-term Charlotte District 6 City Councilman Tariq Bakari will be resigning to become the number two transit official in the United States Department of Transportation. This has this has to have been in the work for a while, but it was a pretty closely held secret, evidently. When did you become aware of it?
Yeah, it was. I mean, inside the government center, no one had any idea. The mayor didn't know. Other council members didn't know. This was kept pretty much under wraps. Soon after Trump became was sworn in, Tariq's name was floated by North Carolina Republicans as someone who could work in his administration. He interviewed throughout January and February and March and came to an agreement. And so, yeah, it was a pretty big surprise. And it was, I think, you know, this happened in late March. If it had happened a week later on April Fool's Day, I think a lot of people might have chalked it up to that kind of a story. But no, this is real and it's happening. Yeah.
Mary, he would become the deputy director of the Federal Transit Administration. What does that job entail?
Yeah, so the big news for Charlotte out of that is that the FTA is responsible for a whole lot of transportation grants, which is obviously a big thing for the region right now, given the transit plan that's on the table. We talk a lot about the sales tax component of that, the new sales tax revenue Mecklenburg County wants to generate, but the plan also calls for billions in federal dollars. So some folks here in Charlotte are optimistic that getting a Charlottean in a position like deputy administrator of the FTA could be good for those plans in the future.
And he's not the first Charlotte official to go to D.C. to be part of the Department of Transportation. Former Charlotte Mayor Anthony Fox ran that department in the Obama administration, and now former Charlotte Congressman Dan Bishop is going to Washington to be at the Office of Management and Budget, which we'll talk about later. What does it say about Charlotte's place in the firmament of politics that officials here are beckoned to Washington, Steve, for bigger jobs?
Yeah, I think it definitely speaks to this city's importance and this state's importance. Like you said, Mike, Anthony Fox became transportation secretary in part because he helped host a successful DNC in 2012. And I mean, that's not the only reason, but it was one reason. It was kind of a reward, a thank you for him pulling that off. And like I said earlier, there are a lot of North Carolina Republicans like Michael Whatley, who, you know, was co-chair of the RNC, who have North Carolina ties. So when it was time for them to fill out the administration, I think people in Trump's term looked to North Carolina and said, you know, hey, who do you have? Who can come up here and help us?
So, Steve, as Mary just said, Bakari would be responsible for awarding billions of dollars in grants to transit projects nationwide. We have our own enormous transit project on the table. Tariq Bakari has often been frustrated with the plan that we have, and he voted against a resolution to support it. Do you see him funneling some federal money into that project to help us execute that plan, or might he be obstructive?
I think Bakari is going to want to help Charlotte in any way that he can. He's a real Charlotte booster. Mm-hmm. I think one of the questions is going to be the timing. transit projects take so long. I mean, if everything goes well in Raleigh and they get approval for the tax, voters would vote it up or down in November. We would start collecting tax revenue in January 2026. These projects, Charlotte's going to have to move quickly to get these projects in front of the FTA while Bakari is still in office. Now, that being said, Bakari's interest and the stuff he's talked about over the last several years, he's really interested in like futuristic ideas, autonomous vehicles, things like that. He's never been a fan of the streetcar. And in every, funding scenario that Charlotte has, they propose building the streetcar. I'm not sure he would look upon that favorably, but in general, I think he's going to want to do what he can to help out Charlotte and help out North Carolina.
I know that he wanted more roads in the project, so he's on the same page as legislators in Raleigh. Mary Tarek Bakari came to city council as part of a trio of young Turks that included Braxton Winston and Larkin Eggleston, and Bakari was the only one left standing in recent years on city council. He's been an outspoken member of council. He's been described by many as a disruptor. Because he's taken positions that are not in the majority and that question the majority. Does that make him the perfect candidate for an administration that appears to be disrupting everything?
Potentially, yeah. As Steve mentioned, Tarek Bakari is someone who has a lot of interest in futuristic technology. Obviously, we've all seen the role that Elon Musk has played in the Trump administration, so could potentially be a good fit there. I think, it'll be a slightly different situation for Councilman Bakari. On the council, he always described himself as extreme minority, one of just two Republicans on the 11-person council. So he sort of saw that as an opportunity to be able to make waves at times, to sort of be a vocal minority on the council. Obviously, being in a Republican administration will be a very different situation in that sense.
Mayor Lyles praised Bakari on social media, saying his contributions on council have been, quote, invaluable. But during his time on council, he's been, as I said, outspoken and on the losing end of several issues. He's referred to fellow Councilman Malcolm Graham as, quote, a political hack. He said that Mayor Vial Lyles is incredibly partisan. That's a quote, though she plays, quote, a kindly grandma on TV. Comments like that are not part of the Charlotte mold, but they are mild descriptions for opponents in terms of how the Trump administration, or particularly Donald Trump, has described opponents. Does that make him a good fit for this administration, Mary, or is he likely to become even more outspoken in D.C.?
We'll have to see. In fairness, deputy administrator of the FTA is certainly a significant position. It's not exactly one that comes with a whole lot of name recognition. It remains to be seen what sort of public platform it will give him and his messaging and how that brand will kind of grow in this new role.
Some of the things he suggested in Charlotte, Steve, they've been out there. I think he was an advocate of talking to Elon Musk and his boring company for drilling tunnels under our busiest intersections. Not much came of that. He was an advocate for putting bulletproof shields on CATS buses at the time when some CATS buses were in, drivers were in danger. As you mentioned, he talked about the impact of self-driving cars. But getting back to how he might or might not aid Charlotte's transportation dreams, his boss in Washington is Sean Duffy, the Secretary of Transportation, who has said his department would take into account a community's birth and marriage rates when awarding grant funding. And as you know from reporting on the Chetty study, we are challenged in at least one of those areas. Talk about that.
Yeah, Charlotte, Mecklenburg County does not have a high marriage rate. Our birth rate is a little bit above the national average, so that's good for the city. And so we will see, Bakari will play a role in kind of writing the detailed directive of how the FTA is going to award grant money, in addition to these, quote, family-friendly metrics that they've talked about. They've also said they want to be very cost-effective, focus on costs and ridership, things like that. So Bakari will play a role in crafting the rules that Charlotte and other cities have to go by in order to get money. And, I think just knowing Bakari, he's pretty impatient. I mean, Mike, you listed all those ideas. Some of them never, you know, amounted to anything, but he likes to move quickly. He likes to do things fast. And so I think that's going to be an important thing for Charlotte, is to get moving and present projects to Washington, maybe if they're not even fully baked yet. I think that's kind of going to be the new reality in Beccari's FTA.
So, Mary, this creates a vacancy on council at the start of what will be an election year for council. State law, I believe, says a Republican who lives in the district must take his place. So who might that be?
One name that's been floated repeatedly is Tarek Beccari's wife, Krista Beccari. She ran unsuccessfully last year for a state house seat, but overperformed other Republicans on the ballot, got some momentum there. And she has, according to WBT News reporting, expressed interest in the role, at least in the short term, for an appointment.
And who makes the decision? Who makes the replacement?
It will be the city council, who have signaled that, like in past similar situations, they will put out a public application, review applicants, and vote from there.
So in the past, and this has happened in the past when people leave council prematurely and seats become vacant between elections, members of council have expressed a desire to appoint people who would promise not to run for re-election in the next election, which will be in November. They haven't always been successful in achieving that goal, but why would they want to make that stipulation, and are they likely to do so this time?
Certainly possible. I think the idea in previous cycles, and that could come again this year, is that the council does not want to prop up someone who would then have an easier chance of winning in November, especially in a district like District 6. This is really the only competitive city council district we have left in Charlotte. Tarek Beccari won his last two re-election bids by less than 500 votes against a very well-funded Democratic challenger. It's a seat, from what I'm hearing, that both sides are going to make a hard play at in the next year.
It's the local news roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Tarek Beccari is only one of two Republicans in the entire government of Mecklenburg County and the city of Charlotte, only two on council right now. Ed Driggs is the other Republican on council. Would whomever takes his seat for the remainder of his term be the shoe-in in November, should they be allowed to run, or should they decide to run for a second term, Steve? Or is that, as she mentioned, he came in fairly close to his Democratic challenger in the last two elections. Is the complexion of that district changing substantially, or is it just him?
No, I think it's changing substantially. I think whoever runs, whether if it's Krista Beccari or any other Republican, it will be a very close race decided by a few hundred votes. And I think this decision on who they appoint is going to be interesting, because this will be, if Krista Beccari does decide that she would like to fill the remainder of his term, it will be interesting to watch the dynamics on council, because in a way, this will be Tarek Beccari's first ask in his new position of power. And it's going to be interesting to watch and see if council, in a way, falls in line with someone who now holds all this power over them in Washington in terms of their billions of dollars of grants. I would assume they will okay Krista as his replacement.
But Tarek's been on council for four terms. So would his disappearance from that from the election in November give Democrats a better chance at taking that seat? Steve?
Yeah, I think anytime there's a new name, that's certainly going to be intriguing. I mean, Stephanie Hand had run against Tarek Beccari twice. There was talk she was going to run at large. Maybe now she comes back and tries for the seat a third time.
And when will his resignation take effect, in 5 seconds or less?
I'm not actually sure. I think it's going to be very soon, in the next few weeks.
We're going to talk about fires in the mountains when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Steve Harrison, WFAE's politics reporter, Julian Berger, our race and equity reporter. Hunter Sines is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Mary Ramsey is the local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Wildfires in the two Carolinas have been in the news for the last several weeks because of dry and often windy conditions. And in western North Carolina, the debris left from Hurricane Helene has been exacerbating firefighting efforts. E.J. Dwiggins is with the North Carolina Forest Service.
The main impact that we're seeing from Helene debris is access issues. So our crews are spending significant amounts of time using chainsaws to cut through Helene debris just to get to where these fires are and begin establishing lines. So anybody that's ever used a chainsaw for more than a couple hours knows how exhausting that can be.
Hunter, at one point this week, there were three wildfires burning in Polk County. They started last week. Have they now been contained?
A little bit contained. They are not fully contained. I think the best one is actually the Fishhook Fire, which spawned about 199 acres. It was due to a downed power line. It is 95% contained. However, the biggest priority, this is actually the highest priority fire in all of the U.S., 476 firefighters from all over the country are coming in to try to put this one and others out. But that is the Black Cove Fire. That's where it's near Saluda. It's 32 acres in size. There have been several evacuation orders in that area for thousands of people, and it is only 17% contained. But Mike, we did just get an update this morning as of 8:45. There is another red flag warning for Western North Carolina. That is until 8 p.m. tonight. And that is due to very dry conditions yet again, and they expect 20 to 25 mile per hour winds with gusts reaching upwards of 30 to 35 miles per hour, which is just another recipe for these to just spread.
And as we know, fighting fires in the mountains is not easy work. Bobby Arledge is Polk County Fire Marshal. Earlier this week, he spoke about just how tough a job firefighters were facing and just how exhausting the work is.
For the most part, we're still doing pretty good. A lot of tired people out here. It's been working 16, 18, 20, 24-hour days. There's a lot of tired people, but we've got a lot of support from all over North and South Carolina and even further.
Governor Josh Stein issued a state of emergency in response to those wildfires. 34 of the state's 100 counties, plus the tribal lands in eastern North Carolina, are all included in that state of emergency, including, this may surprise some people, Mecklenburg, Gaston, Iredell, Lincoln, Rowan, and Union counties in this area. What does that state of emergency allow the governor to do, Hunter?
It basically allows them to pump more resources than initially were. It makes it a top priority. It's kind of like other state of emergencies that we have seen when natural disasters happen, like Helene, actually 6 months ago, just yesterday. But it is important, Mike, you bring up Mecklenburg County, and I was actually at the gym this morning and a few people were talking about, oh, we're going to, you know, do a backyard fire tonight. And I like warned them, like, you cannot light a fire right now. So it is very important to remind everyone there is a no burn rule right now in the state. Like, do not set a backyard fire. Do not set, I wouldn't even put your fireplace fire on right now, just to try to lower the chances of anything happening. I do want to mention really quickly, Mike, because this was an update from this morning, that one thing to really look at is, or keep an eye at today, is actually the fire down in South Carolina. It's the Table Rock Fire. It is in Pickens County, but it just crossed into Transylvania County in the North Carolina mountains. And it doubled in size overnight. It is now 8,600 acres that is burning right now.
And in Rutherford County, evacuation orders were issued earlier this week. I think they were lifted, if I'm not mistaken, on Wednesday. Did they prove to be necessary, or was that just a wise precaution?
I believe, I'm not sure that one specifically. I know there has been a lot of evacuations orders just as a precaution. But compared to other fires in California, there have been about a dozen homes that have been already burned. I will mention, Mike, a really sad reality. There was a guy who saw Helene ravage his home, flood his home. He's getting back into his home, And then he watches on Facebook as it burns 6 months later and there is nothing left. So that's just one example. So take the precautions, take the evacuation seriously. Right now, though, there are thousands that are evacuated, including 3,600 in Columbus alone. That is, I believe, just southeast of Hendersonville, if memory serves me right.
Climate change, two words to sum it all up. For 15 years, this city was the home to the CIAA basketball tournament. It moved to Baltimore several years ago. However, just as the league, the CIAA league, actually moved its headquarters to Charlotte. And now we are pitching for the tournament to come back. We sent a bid to the CIAA for both the men's and women's tournaments. Mary, what was the sales pitch?
Yes, so the three main components are getting all of the events centered at the Spectrum Center. In years past, games and other events were split between the Bojangles Coliseum Complex and the Spectrum Center uptown. Charlotte really now wants to concentrate everything in and around the Spectrum Center, getting folks, both teams and fans, good hotel rates. That was a sticking point when the tournament left for Baltimore a few years ago, and also generating fundraising for a scholarship fund.
Yeah, one of the reasons that they say they were looking for another city and ultimately chose Baltimore is they felt that the fans were not being treated well in Charlotte, either at the restaurants or by some hotels, who they felt, they made allegations that the hotels were overcharging them a bit. And Mike Butts, who is with the Charlotte Regional Visitors Authority, said this week that getting hotels on board has been a bit of a challenge.
And the hotels are responding at different levels, some within and some not.
So we are only competing, Steve, as I understand it, against Baltimore. Is that correct?
Yeah, the deadline for the bids to come through is April 15th, but the CRVA this week said they believe only two cities, Charlotte and Baltimore, are going to bid. So if Charlotte can't deliver those hotel room rates that the CIAA wants, I don't think that's necessarily going to disqualify them, just because they're not that, you know, there's so far only two cities interested in doing this.
So do we know what Baltimore is offering or what the CIAA likes about that city as compared to us?
Something that has come up in discussions amongst city leaders and also on a trip they took to this year's tournament in Baltimore is, again, that Baltimore was able to secure really relatively low hotel rates, both great packages for the schools that are bringing their teams to town for the tournament and for fans, that they did a really good job of centering the tournament in one part of town that had really great amenities, recently a renovated arena. So those are two of the big things. Another sticking point I wanted to mention that came up this week. So the CIAA asked for bids to host the tournament from 2027 to 2029. As I mentioned, Charlotte really wants to center everything at the Spectrum Center, but there are scheduling conflicts at the Spectrum Center in 2027. It's already slated to host the ACC tournament and some NCAA tournament first round games. So Charlotte actually plans to bid for 2028 through 2030. So we'll have to see too whether that affects the city's chances going for a slightly different time frame than what the league was initially looking for.
Steve.
And I was going to say, I mean, in the past, one reason why the city split the tournament with early games at Bojangles and then the late round games at Spectrum Center is that financially it just didn't make a lot of sense to hold everything at the Spectrum Center. One, I mean, the Spectrum Center is very busy with the Hornets and other events, and the early round games at the CIAA just aren't very well attended. And so you would open up the giant arena with not very many people there. It was, you know, I don't think the Hornets, it was financially working out well for them to open this giant building for not very many people, but that's kind of the new request, to have everything in one place.
And the attendance seems to be one of the things that Baltimore has given them. The attendance has risen for those tournament games in the city of Baltimore. Is that because of Baltimore's proximity to the Washington, D.C. metro area and to the Philadelphia metro area?
That I don't know. I think one argument, though, you know, the tournament, I'll say this, the tournament was in Charlotte for 15 years. And so I think probably a lot of alums, I think you'd be excited to go somewhere new. It's kind of an annual event. It's something people put on their schedule. And now you get to go to a new city and have a different experience. So that could be part of it as well.
Yeah.
And if we are going to talk about size of alumni base, I think one of the selling points Charlotte is trying to pitch is that I believe a majority, maybe even close to 2/3 of the CIAA schools are in North and South Carolina. So certainly sizable alumni bases in the Charlotte area too.
Well, it's budget time at Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. And despite the loss of $100 million in federal funding as COVID relief dollars end and more funds earmarked for DEI efforts are cut by the Trump administration, CMS Superintendent Dr. Crystal Hill has recommended a budget for the next school year of $2.1 billion, which would provide for pay raises. WFAE's education reporter James Farrell is going to join us now for a few minutes to talk about that. James, how does this $2.1 billion budget compare to previous years?
Yeah, so the actual operating budget, which funds sort of the main operations of the school, is $1.95 billion. And Superintendent Hill has said that that's a roughly, it's a less than 1% increase from last year's operating budget. Now, they are requesting $667 million from the county. That is a $28 million increase from what they got from the county last year, or roughly a 4% increase. That is a little bit less than what they've requested in the past from the county. I believe last year it was actually around double that amount that they asked.
And she's asking for about $28 million more dollars from the county than she did last year. That's about 4% more, but as you just said, it's only 1% more in the overall budget. We're going through an inflationary period, as everybody knows, and that also includes the loss of those federal dollars that I mentioned a few seconds ago, but you would think this would put the system in dire straits, but Crystal Hill says not to worry.
We are not making any cuts to the student experience. The cuts that we've made are at the central office or any positions that may already be vacant. So there should be no change.
So how is she accomplishing this?
Yeah, so the district is kind of trying to move things around to try to cut around without having to go into the classroom to cut. So they're holding back on filling 40 vacant positions. I have been told that it's possible that as they reassess the budget situation, since there's a lot of assumptions in the air right now, it's possible some of those could come back. But the plan right now is to hold back on 40 vacant teaching positions. CMS officials said that amounted to about $3.4 million worth of funding that they're basically holding back right now. They're also making a lot of cuts at the central office level. They describe these as sort of kind of trying to look for redundancies that they were cutting or using different systems or cutting third-party contracts, things like that. There are a couple of vacant positions there as well that they're cutting. That amounted to about $3.8 million in cuts from the central office budget that would go toward funding certain salary increases for assistant principals and a couple of other positions like that. So basically kind of trying to move around in other ways outside of, you know, making cuts in the classroom. Now, 40 vacant teaching positions, how that might affect the classroom kind of remains to be seen. I know the Charlotte Observer had a story about student-teacher ratios potentially going up a little bit. But the district is really maintaining that this is going to protect, like Superintendent Hill said there, the student experience and not get into the classroom too much.
As she did say that this year's budget is tight, that's nothing new. It's always tight. But at the same time, she is recommending these raises. Her budget proposes asking Mecklenburg County for an additional $28.3 million, more than she did last year. And $26 million of that is earmarked to go to pay raises. Who will be on the receiving end of those raises, and how would they work?
Right. So a big portion of that is that the district is asking the county to help fund an average 5% increase to the local supplement that Mecklenburg County helps. Remember that teacher salary is primarily funded through the state, which sets the base salary, but counties are able to add this additional supplement. So this would be an average 5% increase in the teacher supplement at Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools. The way that's been described is that it would be at least 4% across the board for everyone, with an additional 1% raise for teachers who have been there for more than 15 years. That was a priority from the administration and the school board because at the state level, the state salary schedule kind of gets a little stagnant after 15 years. So this was supposed to be an effort to try to kind of reward those more experienced teachers who have been working in the district for longer or working as teachers for longer. The other element of pay raises that they're looking for is to fund what they're calling the phase two of their compensation study. You might remember that the district raised minimum wages for their classified staff. That's people like custodians, bus drivers, non-certified staff that works in the schools. They focused on raising the minimum wage to $20 earlier this year. They want to look ahead into next year of looking for more pay raises for some of the employees who are a little bit on the higher end of that pay scale that didn't see raises, and seeing if they can increase those as well.
We're going to be talking more about this, obviously, in the coming weeks, and as the county discusses this proposal later on. When will the school board finalize what they're presenting to the county?
Yes, so the school board will be having a public hearing on this on April 8th, and then they are set to vote on it to adopt it at on April 22nd. But like you said, yeah, this will then go to the county for further consideration as the county goes through its budgeting process.
James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter, thank you for joining us for a moment or two here.
You're welcome.
And it's the local news roundup this morning on Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. Hunter, we've been hearing all week about this genetic testing company, 23andMe, filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy and raising concerns over the safety of the genetic information they have stored and provided to their, some, I think, 7 million customers. North and South Carolina Attorneys General Jeff Jackson and Alan Wilson have joined other attorneys general around the country in urging people to delete their information. Do we know how many North Carolinians or South Carolinians may be in that company's database?
I do not know that number offhand. I'm not sure if even Attorney General Jeff Jackson mentioned that when he put out his own warning. However, the biggest concern here is, unlike, you know, your email addresses, your genetic data cannot be changed if it is compromised. And it can lead to, of course, multiple things. I mean, one thing is to have your credit card information that you can cancel, or your email address or phone number. It's a whole other thing to have your DNA sequence compromised. So the biggest thing is getting into that website, if you do, and filling out the right forms to ask them to delete it, because we don't know. The biggest concern is you don't know who it's going to be sold to after it goes bankrupt. And right now it could be prone to hackers or those new buyers and what they are going to do under their own new conditions.
So there is a process for going to the 23andMe website and asking them to delete your genetic information. But how do we know that that will happen? And is this like a hard drive? They say a hard drive, if you sell a computer, erase the hard drive. Well, the hard drive is not completely erased. And if you are somebody with nefarious intent, you can probably get to some secret information on that hard drive, even if it's been erased. How do we know?
I don't think we do know, Mike. I think you and I are both skeptics. I am definitely skeptics of technology, especially with the cloud and everything up in space. So, I would say there's no promise that it actually is completely deleted. I think it's just a step for safety to say that you have at least done what you can.
When we come back, we're going to talk about immigration challenges in Charlotte, both from the sheriff's point of view and from the backlog that has existed for quite some time in Charlotte's immigration courts. That's why Julian Berger is with us, our race and equity reporter from WFAE News, and we'll get to that in just a moment. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaOfSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Hunter Sines, a reporter for WSOC-TV. Steve Harrison is WFAE's politics reporter. And Julian Berger is our race and equity reporter. In the last couple of years, Mecklenburg County Sheriff Gary McFadden was in the company of other Democratic sheriffs around the state in refusing to cooperate with the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Service and their 287G program. But late last year, the General Assembly passed a law which forces all sheriffs in the state to cooperate with ICE by holding suspects they have determined are undocumented for at least 48 hours to allow ICE the time to pick them up. Mecklenburg Sheriff Gary McFadden is cooperating, but is also releasing these people when ICE does not arrive in time to take them into custody. He doesn't notify ICE that he's about to release them because, he says, the law does not require it. Sheriff McFadden was on this program this week, and we talked about cooperation being a two-way street. You're asking ICE to be more cooperative with you. You would like them to let you know when they're about to conduct an operation so you can get the jail ready for the people they round up, I suppose. So why not extend the courtesy to them to make the phone call, I'm going to release this prisoner in 2 hours?
Well, I think that they have that already. I give them 48 hours.
And this has raised some questions about McFadden's level of cooperation, but he says those questions should be posed to ICE.
We should ask ICE, why haven't they picked up the 163 people that were left and bonded out of the Mecklenburg County Detention Center? They will not give us an answer on why they won't pick them up. I have emailed them. I have expressed my concern that we are holding these people at the cost of $199 a day, $398 per stay. As of last Monday, $68,000. Of the taxpayers' money.
So do we not get reimbursed by the federal government for holding these people?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
That's a good question.
This is a problem that's being experienced, Julian, in other counties around the state, too. House Speaker Destin Hall has noted this and submitted House Bill 318, which came up for consideration this week in the House Judiciary Committee. What would it do, and where does it stand at the moment?
Yeah, House Bill 318, we're still waiting to see what happens. It was filed, but there hasn't been much recent action on it. And House Bill 318 adds an extra layer where during that 48-hour period, sheriffs have to call ICE 2 hours before individuals are actually going to be released. So there is an extra layer of communication that sheriffs have to provide with ICE.
And yet, even when they are called, we are told from sheriffs in other parts of the state, they don't come.
No, they don't come. Sheriff McFadden himself on Charlotte Talks on Monday, he says that ICE doesn't seem to have the ability to be able to pick them up, whether that's manpower, whether that's money. And that's something McFadden has asked ICE numerous times, and they haven't been able to answer.
Meanwhile, the backlog of cases at Charlotte's immigration court continues to grow. We have the 9th largest backlog in the country, 146,000 cases waiting to be heard. And the average wait time for all of this is 552 days for the average immigrant waiting for their time in court. Why?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that I've been hearing from the immigrant community, the immigrant advocate community, is that there's a shortage of immigration judges. There's an increase of asylum seekers coming into this country that are trying to get asylum, but the immigration courts can't pick up the pace and go through these cases in a faster manner.
So the backlog predates the Trump administration, but Becca O'Neill with the Carolina Migrant Network claims Trump's efforts at mass deportation are making things worse.
The U.S. government has made a choice to put so many people in removal proceedings and to not give the Executive Office of Immigration Review the resources they need to process the cases.
And Julian, you spoke to one of the people affected by these delays, a woman we are calling Ingrid to protect her identity. She left Nicaragua for the U.S. in 2019 and stayed at the Mexico border until granted parole in 2021. We have translated her description of her experience, which she described this way.
It was very traumatic. I was traumatized by the fact that they told me that I had to go to court. From the moment I went in, I started to shake and I inevitably started to cry.
Is her story unusual or is it the norm?
No, it's the norm. We see a lot of people that are waiting years in order to see if they're accepted for asylum, see if they're accepted for visas. I mean, I was in Charlotte's immigration court last week, and there were people there who are having their final hearing for their asylum in August of 2026. So a year and a half from today, they're waiting years to see what's going to happen with their lives here in the States.
And you report that Ingrid came to Charlotte, as we said, in 2021 and wasn't seen in Charlotte's immigration court until January 2024, 3 years later, at which time she was granted asylum. But those 3 years weighed on her.
The most tense hours of my life, because can you imagine if they had deported me? They denied me asylum and they would send me back to my country, where in my country, what's waiting for us is prison.
You say that she has relatives here who have also been waiting for years to get visas and in the meantime can't get a work permit or a social security number, and their next court date is 2027. How are they supporting themselves?
Yeah, I think that they're really legally not able to work in this country. So that's the biggest thing. There's so much uncertainty. There's that inability to work legally. And you also have that emotional and psychological toll, the day-to-day, what's going to happen with my life in 3 years when my court date is here.
So as long as we're on the topic of immigration and insufficient resources to handle the caseload, we spoke last week about how cutting in Washington was beginning to impact immigration efforts here. And last week, the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy was facing cuts for its pro bono legal representation of unaccompanied minors. These are children who have come into this country without legal status and without a parent or guardian. This week, it was announced that that funding, $900,000, was cut by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services when they terminated work performed by D.C.-based Acacia Center for Legal Justice, which provides money in Charlotte to the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy. What will this mean for their efforts on behalf of these children?
Yeah, so that $900,000 that goes specifically to the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy, it being cut means that they can no longer represent these children in immigration court, unaccompanied minors who come to the country without any family, any parents. And right now there's 300 active cases in the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy. And so they're now at risk of going unrepresented in immigration court.
Christina Saron is with the Charlotte Center for Legal Advocacy.
When I think about all the children that we represent, I think about the uncertainty that they must feel and the confusion that they must be experiencing right now.
And what makes the assistance of the Center for Legal Advocacy important is that an unaccompanied child seeking refuge in the United States is, as we found out last week on this program through you, Julian, is not entitled to a government-appointed lawyer in immigration courts. And these cuts will impact 300 cases. So these children will go to court without legal representation. Is that the bottom line here?
Yeah, basically they're able to go to court by themselves. And speaking to Christina, she told me that children are more than 90% more likely to lose their case and receive a deportation order to go back to their home country without this legal representation.
Okay, well, we'll keep our eye on that. There was movement in Raleigh this week on the Charlotte Transit Plan when a trio of Republican state senators introduced a bill to set up a new public transit authority in the Charlotte area. That's certainly part of the plan, but the important part is allowing for a sales tax referendum to fund it, which these same state senators passed in February or introduced in February. Who are the three senators, Mary, shepherding this plan through the General Assembly?
Yes, so there's Senator Vicky Sawyer, who represents parts of Iredell County as well as parts of North Mecklenburg. She has sort of been the point person for Charlotte area officials in the state Senate. She's been joined, and it's worth noting she's also a co-chair of the Senate Transportation Committee in Raleigh. She's been joined in both of these bills by one of her fellow Republican senators, who's also a co-chair of the Transportation Committee and one of the co-chairs of the Senate Finance Committee, also a Republican, which is something that local officials are really relatively pleased with, given that winning over Republican support has been really important. We haven't seen any bills introduced on the House side yet, but it's worth noting that during the Mecklenburg County legislative briefing earlier this year, Senator Sawyer said she expects Representative Tricia Cotham to be of help on the House side. Again, the only Republican members of the Mecklenburg delegation are Senator Sawyer and Representative Cotham.
So this latest Senate bill, Senate Bill 584, would replace the current governance system for CATS with a new one. Steve, does this does the makeup of the body that as set up in this law comport with what our plan said?
Yeah, I think so. I believe it's 12 members from the city, 12 from the county, and then the governor would get an appointment as well as the Senate leader and the House speaker. So Raleigh would have some role in governing the new transit authority. If the sales tax bill moves, this will move as well. They're kind of tied together. So we'll see. And I think I'll just say one more thing. I think going back to Tariq Bakari going to Washington to the FTA, I think that probably does improve the chances of the sales tax bill moving. I think there's probably a sense among other Republicans in the legislature to create some goodwill. They might not benefit from Charlotte sales tax, but they might benefit from a friendly face in Washington, D.C. So we'll see.
So this bill also calls for acquiring all of CAT's assets from the city and then reimbursing Charlotte for what it's paid to purchase the Norfolk Southern tracks for the Red Line. We've spoken for months now about how we bought those tracks with no guarantees that the sales tax would come to be, and therefore no way to prove that we could actually put a train on those tracks. This fixes that. Did we know that would be part of this bill when we bought the tracks, Steve?
Yeah, I think there was always a plan that when we spent, I guess it was about $90 million to buy the tracks, that it was a gamble that there would be a transit sales tax in the future, and that money, part of that money, would go and reimburse the city. So it was a gamble, but that was always the plan all along.
So 9 years ago, in 2016, the state made national news with the passage of HB 2, which became known as the bathroom bill. It tarnished our reputation. It cost us millions of dollars. It lost the state some major sports events and concerts, and eventually it was repealed. That was then. This is now, and something similar is back. Republican lawmakers proposed Senate Bill 516, which has been compared to the old bill. Hunter, what would this one do?
So a number of things. It would codify the definitions under state law of sex to include only male and female descriptions. It would also prevent people from actually changing their gender on their birth certificates and ID cards after reassignment surgery. And one of the other highlights, of course, when it comes to bathrooms, is it would regulate which bathrooms people are allowed to use in some state buildings, but that also includes public schools and prisons where you would have to use the bathroom that is your gender assigned at birth.
It's not quite as onerous as the original bill when it comes to bathrooms, but it's similar in many ways. And this idea of not allowing a change on your driver's license or your passport or things like that to comport with what you have done with yourself because of surgery makes a problem when you try to leave the country, right?
I mean, just imagine when you're trying to go to TSA of how confusing that is going to be for the agent that is seeing something on a card that is completely different than what is in front of them because it's not allowed. So you can imagine the problems that could come from this. I will say there was a supplemental bill that was also added that would change the rules for child abuse, clarifying that it would be okay for parents or foster parents to actually refuse to acknowledge their transgender children's gender identities. We see this a lot in hospitals, and we know the mental health component of this community, suicide rates higher, depression rates higher. They already go through heartbreaking challenges in this world. And so this one really stuck out to me.
It's the Local News Roundup on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. We saw, Steve, a hugely negative response to HB2, which pales in comparison to some of the changes coming out of the Trump administration in Washington and which some corporations appear to be embracing rather than trying to fight. Is the same thing liable to happen with this new Senate bill in North Carolina? Nobody's going to say anything. We're just going to go through with it.
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see how far this goes. The News and Observer had an interview with Phil Berger, the Senate leader, this week, and he was a bit lukewarm on it. Didn't give it his full endorsement. He kind of gave we'll just wait and see what happens. So it's not certain that SB 516 is going to pass. But Mike, going back to what you said earlier, the political landscape has changed so much since 2016. Other states have passed similar legislation. So if this does become, I guess the General Assembly would have to pass it. Governor Stein would veto it. Then there would have to be an override. If it does become law, I think that the reaction and the outcry would be much more muted today than it was back with HB2.
The architect of HB2 was Dan Bishop. He was a member of the legislature at the time. He introduced the bill, went on to Congress, ran unsuccessfully recently to be the state's attorney general, but now he's moving back to Washington. What, Steve, will he be doing?
He has been confirmed in the Senate, 53-45, to be Deputy Director of the Office of Management and Budget. And what that means, he will be the number two in that office. The number one is Russell Vaught, who was a big creator of the Project 2025. The kind of the main job that that organization is being tasked with is how to reduce the size of government without congressional approval. And Vaught, there was an interview this week talking about the cuts, cheerleading the cuts at HHS, all the job losses. So that is what Dan Bishop will be doing.
And of his confirmation, Trump said, quote, "Dan will implement my cost-cutting and deregulatory agenda across all agencies and root out the weaponized deep state." So I guess he's Elon Musk 2.0. We'll see. Steve Harrison, our politics reporter here at WFA News, also joined by Julian Berger, our race and equity reporter, Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter at The Observer, and Hunter Sines from WSOC-TV. Thanks.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. We have additional production help from Jesse Steinmetz. For more information on Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.